morning. I'm Simon Unwin. You are listening to The Third Degree. And this week, we're going to learn about the Democratic Republic of the Congo, aka the DRC. It's something of a tragic hotspot for armed conflict and mineral exploitation, but we don't often hear much about this nation in Africa. It's a windy, freezing Friday night in Marrickville, and I've just stepped into a warehouse party. It's not your average warehouse party. There's tables piled high with cassava and bean casseroles. The air's full of vocal harmonies. This is Party Like Papa Wemba, an event hoping to raise funds for independent media collectives in West Papua and in the Congo. I'm here with Mboye Chiantende and Patrice Nyembo of the Congolese Community of Australia. We're talking about the human rights and environmental abuses occurring in the Congo and what it's like to be a journalist there.
10 million of Congolese have been killed since 1996 until now, and every day about 1,000 women are raped and they are tortured.
Mboye says that these atrocities have a lot to do with the rich mineral resources of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. These resources include huge deposits of diamonds, copper, and coltan, a mineral used in the production of phones and computers.
These people, these politicians of the world, these big businessmen of the world, have one goal: to rape Congolese resources.
And so why do you think that these stories don't make it to Australia? Why are we not hearing about this every week?
Exactly, because Australia is part of this evil thing. Australia is
complice.
Australia is complice. That's why they don't. So they follow USA, what USA is doing. And they support, as I say, Australia has backed Rwanda as a member of Commonwealth. So they can't make a denunciation against Rwanda, because all these they support a group of people called M23. So it's called a rebellion group. Rebellion against the authority of Congolese, Congolese authority, but they come from Rwanda, they kill Congolese, and the UN is there. Everybody knows about the situation, but they can't stop because they benefit from this killing.
So what is it like to be a journalist in Congo trying to report on these stories, trying to bring these stories to the world?
It depends which kind of journalist, because most of the journalists now work on the benefits of the government, the politician in power. So we need an independent journalist who can spread the truth to the world.
That's Mboye Chiantende of the Congolese Community of Australia. Just after dinner, but before the dancing begins, Patrice Nyembo shows us some video footage that he took when he was last in the Congo. It shows hundreds of cars and trucks sitting idle on the shoulder of a ruined road. The government of the DRC is unable to maintain roads and other basic services, so this road, supposedly a highway, is an unsealed track, riven with staggeringly deep potholes full of mud. One after another, trucks full of ore and buses full of people negotiate this choke point, but only after waiting here for up to 2 weeks and paying hundreds of US dollars in bribes. But, Patrice tells us, he had to stop filming.
You were also saying when you were taking that footage, you had to be keeping an eye out all the time for police.
Yeah, they came. They came, they undercover. And those undercover, they are hiring the Tutsis.
From Rwanda?
From Rwanda.
As a security.
If you were very careful, you could see a man there watching us. And at that time, we just leave the place and go. That is really very important for us to assist the journalist in order to bring the reality, the truth. And the truth will set us free. They will not run. I've been even with people who were there when Anvil Manning was killing more than 200 people. That's why we need your support in order to give them some sophisticated electronic equipment to bring all the truth here in Australia.
I heard you say that Free Congo Media is very much taking taking its cues from the Free West Papua Media. Why is that? What do you think are the similarities between West Papua and Congo?
The similarity, it's the abuse of human rights and the degradation of the environment. That is the similarity. Because always where there is degradation of environment, if you look, there must be also human rights abuse. Those things are going together. We are living in this planet, and everything we do in one part of this planet impacts to all the citizens of the world. That's why I can say there is a similarity. We are human beings.
While ordinary Congolese struggle with decaying infrastructure and roads, mining companies operate private airports. Patrice says that a private airport near where he shot the footage is better even than the airport in the nation's capital. It services the giant copper mine at Fungurume.
In Fungurume, there is a airport which is better, more than the Kinshasa. Congolese are not allowed, even if you are a president, you can use it.
Rehabilitation of the mine sites is rare.
They just make the open pit. They don't even fill them. They just destroy the forest, the environment. They just leave the open pits widely open. They don't care to fill them up like we used to do before. Now it's finished. They are busy taking money, resources.
Patrice and Mboy also describe temporary mobile mining operations working in some areas of the Congo that can move off at short notice.
They are stealing. At any time, they can remove it. Why? Because you remember when you be the inspector of the minings, they used to bring mercenaries to kill the elites in order to stop the work and bring their own engineers. But what we used to do, they can bring that war, we can run, and when we come back, we can start again. But now there is no way. All the commands of the metallurgic companies are on the wheel.
And they can move any time?
They can move at any time.
Wow.
And there is no hold.
So they move from place to place really often?
They can move out from Congo.
No, because they say... They know that it's temporary.
Temporary.
They are stealing. So when you steal something, you can't build forever.
Yeah.
So you do something quick. And when something happens, you move.
So not just a getaway car, but a getaway mine, a getaway headquarters.
Yes.
They move the whole thing.
Yes. Yeah. And if you can see, they sabotage the highway. They leave only the road and the tracks. The same day they take the minerals, the same day it go out from Congo.
That's Patrice Mnyembo and Mwe Chitiantende of the Congolese Community of Australia. There are a number of Australian-based mining companies operating in the Congo, including BHP Billiton, Austral Africa Resources, Green Machine Development Corporation, Lindian Resources, Mawson West, and Tiger Resources. Chart Fabricatorian is an independent journalist and contributor to the International Current Affairs program on this station, Neighbourhood Watch. Last year, he travelled to and worked in Central Africa, and he joins me now to discuss what it was like to be a journalist in that part of the world.
How's it going, Simon? Pleasure to be here.
Cheers, Chart. What was it like reporting on the stories that were happening in that part of the world at the time?
The thing about DRC is that it's actually... journalistically speaking, the place to be in Africa, and has been for a couple of years now. I mean, if you go back through the last 10 or 15 years worth of history in Eastern Congo, you know, after the Rwandan genocide in 94, there was a lot of, conflict as, you know, both rebels and refugees, fled across the Rwandan border into Congo and, you know, basically made mayhem. So there was a series of four wars between 98 and 2002 in DRC. And at that point, the volcano just outside the biggest provincial capital in eastern Congo erupted and wiped out a fair slate of the town. So it's fair to say that these guys have not had the best of runs, you know, over the last 10 years. And obviously there's been a whole bunch of violence, and I'm sure that a lot of your listeners will have seen, you know, just in the last couple of months, that all of this has flared up again with a rebel body that is allegedly backed by the Rwandan government, although, of course, they've denied that. But look, so far as my personal experience goes, it's actually this incredibly invigorating place. You're never short of a story. There is always something to do. And there's always, I think, some new angle to explore. So because there's just so much happening within DRC that, you know, even the, you know, limited amount. I mean, I know we're all aware that DRC doesn't get the amount of coverage that it deserves in Western media. But, you know, even the limited amount doesn't begin to do justice to the amount of, you know, the texture of stories that are out there. So, for example, one of the stories that I sort of chased when I was over there was how media, journalists, operate in these kind of conditions.
Right, because, I mean, do foreign journalists like yourself have more freedom to operate in Congo than locally-based journalists?
That's an interesting question. I would suggest that that assertion is probably true of a place like Rwanda, where the government is very keen to make a positive impression on Western investment. In Congo, it's a little bit different because you know, the government just really, especially in Eastern Congo, just has no real control over anything, really. So it's kind of all down to, you know, hand-to-hand contacts and provincial governorships, and there's really not a whole lot of control from Kinshasa. So, you know, so far as that goes, I don't think that, you know, you're particularly done favors or, you know, handicapped by the lack of government control. I would say that where it comes in is that people are more willing, I guess, to talk to, you know, locals. Because if you're coming in as an outsider, there's no reason for them to trust you. And trust is such a huge part of, you know, these interactions, you know, to get the kind of detail, to tell the story in a way that does it justice.
You were telling us earlier about radio journalists who broadcast from certain towns in the DRC?
Absolutely. So this was a really interesting story because, you know, when I went to South Kivu, Bukavu is the provincial capital of South Kivu, and, you know, in particular in Eastern Congo, there's a whole bunch of villages just basically out in the jungle in the middle of nowhere, right? And so radio is an incredibly important medium for communicating information. And just because, there's, you know, obviously there's no televisions in a lot of these villages, there's hardly any electricity, so, you know, a lot of them are just battery-operated radios. And so, you know, you have these, in particular, I spoke to a couple of women who run this radio station in Bukavu, and they're well-educated. You know, one of them was training to be a lawyer, I think. One of them was actually formally educated as a journalist, have been doing it for about 10 years. And they run programs on women's rights, human rights, kind of democracy, governance issues, these kind of, you know, heavy duty things that, you know, the word needs to be gotten out about. And it's not just that they run these programs and then, you know, people in these villages then hear them on their radios. They then sort of also run programs where women, in particular, women from these villages, go back to provincial capitals like Bukavu and get trained up by these women and go back and then start doing community journalism, which is absolutely fantastic. And it's, you know, real grassroots stuff that is actually having a real world impact.
Yeah. To return to something that you were saying a little bit earlier on about how, you know, there's such a richness, a wealth of stories that are happening in the DRC, but so few of them actually make the news internationally. Mm. Now, why do you think that is?
It pains me to say this, but I almost think that Congo is kind of like, I liken it to the gun debate in the US, which is that even though people kind of know that it's important and that they should be talking about it, it's very difficult to put a new angle on it because, well, editors kind of have this idea that it's very difficult to put a new angle on it because, you know, it's this stereotypical image of, you know, starving child, you know, war, raped women, all of that kind of things.
We all have this dim awareness that bad things have been happening there for a long period of time, but
absolutely,
we couldn't describe that in detail.
Absolutely. But the thing is that, you know, like the comparison to the gun debate is that people kind of know that that's important, but they also know that, you know, it's in inverted commas pointless to talk about it because nothing is ever going to change. The debate is just so entrenched that, you know, it what we do isn't going to kind of set any new path, new trajectory. And it's the whole debate has just been, or the whole issue has just been done and dusted. And I really think that that is kind of one of the problems with coverage of Africa in general, but DRC in particular.
I suppose, though, that some of the information that comes to light in the story that we're about to play kind of gives the lie to that to a certain extent.
Yeah, it does. I mean, so this particular story I did about a month ago when this was all flaring up. The basic premise is that Rwanda has been, you know, actively meddling in Congo's affairs for a long time and in Eastern Congo's affairs because there is obviously a lot of mining wealth in Eastern Congo, and Rwanda's economic development is in part premised on the mineral wealth that gets brought through the very porous border with Congo,
and that's particularly coltan, the mineral that's used in most of our phones and laptops?
Coltan, for sure. But, you know, also gold, diamonds, you know, a whole bunch of minerals, copper as well. What's interesting to me about this particular story, or the subsequent developments to when I recorded this story, is that there actually has been some movement in terms of aid donors. So the United States, I think Congress passed legislation saying that, you know, even though it was a token amount, that they would not be allowed to, you know, continue funding Rwanda. And that's a big deal because Rwanda is a very important ally, regional ally of the United States. The same for United States, for Sweden, and for the Netherlands. And I think Germany is, last time I looked, thinking about it as well. So these, you know, big aid donors, kind of important aid donors. And that I have to say that actually has surprised me because, you know, in previous instances, there really has been kind of a lot of heat, but not a whole lot of action in terms of repercussions. So,
in terms of the aid money that Rwanda receives from Western donors,
that's right,
being withheld on the grounds that that they're supporting, you know, armed conflict in the neighbouring Congo.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So, we might play that story now. So, this is when was this filed, Sean?
This was filed mid July, so just about a month ago now.
The M23 is the rebellion in eastern Congo that's been widely reported as a mutiny from within the Congolese military, which is a misnomer to call it a mutiny because it's the latest in a long line of invasions and support of proxy rebels by the Rwandan military.
That's Claude Gatabuke, a survivor of the 1994 Rwandan genocide and executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. He says the report, authored by the UN group of experts, contains damning evidence about the role of key Rwandan government figures in stirring instability in Congo.
The UN report is pointed to the fact that the Rwandan Defense Minister, James Kabarebe, the Rwandan Military Chief of Staff, Charles Kayonga, and a Rwandan general advisor to the president of Rwanda are actively helping the M23 defectors that have spoken to the UN and various other organizations, including Human Rights Watch, have indicated that they were recruited in Rwanda at least 2 months before the so-called mutiny by the M23.
The primary leader of the M23 is General Bosco Ntaganda, an alleged war criminal who's wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of using child soldiers and committing atrocities in the Congo. His roots, however, are Rwandese. In the 1990s, he fought as part of Paul Kagame's Rwandan Patriotic Front to successfully defeat the genocidal Hutu regime in power at the time. Since then, he's spent much time with a variety of rebel groups in the Congo, with M23 just the latest in a long line. But even if General Ntaganda retains long-standing links with Paul Kagame, now the Rwandan president, that doesn't on its own explain Rwanda's actions in DRC. I asked Claude Gatabuke what Rwanda had to gain by supporting the M23 and meddling in the affairs of eastern Congo. He identified two main reasons.
One is that the ICC reported at the beginning of this year that they were going to go hard and try to arrest General Bosco Ntaganda. He's creating a rebellion so that he can stay at large. If he was to be brought to court with his implications and his long working relationship with the Rwandan government would come to light and the Rwandan military would be implicated. So it's in the interest of the Rwandan military to delay as much as possible and maybe even stop any kind of process that would take General Bosco Ntaganda to court. Number two are economic reasons. Illegal mining, illegal exploitation of Congolese minerals has been taking place for the last 15 years. And in the last 15 years, Rwanda's export of minerals coming from Congo have been in the billions of dollars. A few years ago, a U.S. official mentioned that it would be very difficult for Rwanda give up such a large amount that contributes to its economy. And individuals and businesses that are tied to the Rwandan government have flourished and made a lot of money off of this illegal mining and illegal exploitation of natural resources, which Congo is very rich in.
But in addition to these, there are other factors too. The UN report charges that various Rwandan officials have mounted a wide-ranging effort to convince Congolese businessmen, politicians, and former rebels to prosecute a new war to obtain a secession of North and South Kivu, the populous, mineral-rich provinces of Congo which border Rwanda and which share ethnic and historical ties with it.
If possible, if there was a way to actually make the Kivus part of Rwanda, they would shoot for that. So the leadership in Rwanda is angling to continue to, at a minimum, occupy the Kivu areas of Congo and, if possible, make it a territory of Rwanda, or at least a Rwandan colony.
Now, you're calling for the US to withhold all military support and aid to Rwanda, or the violence that's being perpetrated at the moment is just going to continue. But to what extent is Rwanda responsible for Congo's problems? How much of it, like, for example, the fighting on the border between North and South Kivu, how much of it is largely internal conflicts to DRC?
According to the report, not a lot of it. The group of experts report, these are UN experts, there are certain groups that are fighting inside of the Congo, and today there is no sign that shows that Congolese people are fighting within themselves. There is definitely an issue of governance in the Congo. However, that is not an excuse for foreign countries to invade the Congo with no reason other than exploiting its resources.
To what extent is Rwanda's position as a strong ally of the United States and the West generally in East Africa important in this context? Do you think it's likely that Rwanda will be sanctioned or punished by the international community for its ongoing destabilizing role?
Rwanda is backed and sponsored by the United States and the United Kingdom. They are the top donor nations to Rwanda. And neither of them have come forward to hold Rwanda accountable for crimes committed in the Congo. There is even a law on the books that was sponsored by President Obama when he was senator and co-sponsored by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Section 105 of that law says any countries deemed to destabilize the Congo, the United States Secretary of State has powers to withhold aid from those countries. And it's been 15 years. Obama's been in power for 4 years. Hillary Clinton has been Secretary of State for 4 years. The Bush administration did not enforce that law, and the Obama administration did not enforce that law. They have finally, after 15 years, actually acknowledged Rwanda's involvement in the Congo with the M23 rebels. The State Department released a statement on Saturday saying that they urge Rwanda to stop interfering in the Congo. However, that is not enough, given the human toll and the destruction of communities. There has been, there are more than 1 million people displaced in the Congo, and more than 200,000 people have been displaced as a result of this latest rebellion.
That was Claude Gatabuke there, Executive Director of the African Great Lakes Action Network, on Rwanda's recent interventions in its western neighbour, Congo. He spoke to Shant Fabricatorian last month. That's all from The Third Degree for this week. Have a great morning. ¶¶